You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stuart Goldsmith here. I am talking today on the Comedian's Comedian podcast to Leo Reich. I didn't check with him whether it should be pronounced Reich or like how hard you lean into the Reich, because it's a hell of a word, isn't it? He's a hell of a comic. He's a comedian and a writer. And his debut, which is called Literally Who Cares, culminated in a sold-out show at Earth Hackney. That show was then filmed as an HBO special by A24, right? So this is the territory. Debut show turned into an HBO special. Leo is something really special. And as you will hear at the very beginning of this interview, where I think we started from a point of view. We started from a place of me saying, I'm angry at how good you are, given how young you are. And that's very much the theme of this, how young he is. And also, we're going to talk about sincerity and how young people engage with sincerity or fail to. And I'll also probably bang on about being cringe. It's just me. You can join the Insiders Club at patreon.com/comcompod, where you can watch the full episode. Yes, you heard me right. You can watch the full episode and you can get access to over 30 minutes of bonus features. Producer Callum would like me to point out it's 35 minutes 22 to be exact, because we banged on for ages and it is all great gear. The extra stuff includes Leo on the development of the debut show and what I mean is, if you're a deep comedy fan like me, aka Spod, he gets into the development of his debut show and how it turned into becoming a parody of the previous intended debut show. What a means. If you don't understand that, you have to listen to The Insiders, because it is an absolutely, it's sort of an insane curveball idea of how one might go about making a show, and it's beautiful. We also talk about his experience taking the show around the world from Melbourne to New York and other stuff besides. So over half an hour of stuff and the ability to watch the whole episode at patreon.com/comcompod. So in the first half, we're going to talk about launching a debut hour on the cusp of the pandemic. We'll talk a lot about sincerity. We'll talk about his experience working with the late and very wonderful Adam Brace. This is Leo Reich. What were your intentions for that show? Was it like, this will be my debut and hopefully I'll make some waves and people will come, hopefully I'll build an audience, or I'll, because you're not even, as far as I know, someone who's got a million followers on TikTok and got them to come to the show.
Not even, no, not even at all. The intention was to try and do a really good Fringe show, and that was genuinely, but that was always my dream as a teenage comedy like fucking rat. My absolute pinnacle, and still kind of, to be honest, the thing that I'm happiest about the show is that it went really well in Edinburgh. And the whole dream for me as a teenager was when I went to Edinburgh, and then in those shows which kind of have word of mouth, people are like, you've got to fucking try and get into the Monkey Barrel 2 at 9 a.m. to get to this, you know, like that kind of buzz thing, and that community atmosphere, and the feeling that everyone's like doing this mental month of incredibly self-sabotaging and emotionally damaging work for kind of little to no reason. That was the thing that I always really wanted to be part of. So that was like that intention-wise on that level. I really just wanted Edinburgh to go really well.
And did you, like, someone who has had this level of kind of reaction to the show, often those are people who could have gone earlier and waited and were tactical and had a game plan and like, I'm going to polish that up. We were talking about another actor earlier on who I wouldn't accuse of necessarily having a game plan, but who was kind of
piece themselves together. I need that skill. I need that skill. I'm going to assemble these.
Yeah, yeah.
Was this a case of like waiting until this show was ready? Or did you literally go, this is going to be my first show. I wrote it in a year and it happened to be perfect by the time it got there.
No, well, I wanted to do it in 2020. I don't have patience for anything. And I can't keep... The idea of, like, keeping something in until it's ready just does not, like, work for me at all. I'm so, like, desperate to get stuff out immediately. And I had something in 2020, which I'm so glad I wasn't able to do. Silver lining.
What was that?
Huge silver lining. It was a really, like, anecdotal, confessional, like, narrative comedy show. It was, like, just stand-up. No, like, all the kind of costume makeup stuff, all the songs, none of that was in it. It was just truly me doing a confessional as myself story show in, like, a very classic fringy way. And then it was the pandemic, so I couldn't do it. And over the pandemic, I was like, what the fuck was that? That was terrible. And I would watch the video over and over again, being like, what? Thank God you never performed this for a month.
Okay.
By day two, you would have absolutely jumped into the sea, because it's so deeply not me at all to be... Like, it had, like, a full 45-minute mark, like, and that's when I realised that really what we all need is hope. You know, that kind of thing. I've never said anything that earnest in my private life.
Okay, how did it end up being that? Well, I want to find out what, if anything, was kind of kept from that and taken forwards, or was it simply like a reaction against it? We'll get to that in a second. But how did you end up there, given what you're doing now? How did you end, why were you doing an earnest show?
I don't know. I think it's just like the dumb, I was like, I've been doing stand-up now. I just graduated uni. I've been doing loads of sketch comedy at uni, and I was like, well, I can't really do sketch because of loads of different reasons. People didn't live near me and stuff, and no one cares about sketch in general these days, which is sad.
Nicely picked up as you slag off sketch.
I
obviously
love sketch.
And it's tragic when everyone thinks it's shit.
No, I'm sketch's biggest offender. But it meant that I was like, well, I'm going to do stand-up. And it felt like that was at that point, like, prevailing, like, mode of doing that, I think, especially the Fringe, or had been for about 10 years probably, was to take true stories from your life and weave them into a, like, satisfying narrative, like a kind of, you know, a Mike Birbiglia style. I mean, I love these comics and those shows, like, always loved those shows. But me doing it was crazy because it rang so... Well, I think, watching it back, I think it rings really false because that's not... I'm not someone who's sort of sitting around being like, ah, the beautiful threads of my life that I can weave together.
Sure.
I'm someone who's sitting around going, ah!
Yes, mainly. Yes. And that's kind of a premise of the show, or like a core value of the show is, I don't know what I think. I do have some really big thoughts, I've been told.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of that undercutting the idea, like that is an element of it which is sincere, in fact. That's, you know, it's a very honest thing to say, to sort of mock yourself for going, I've got some huge opinions that I change from day to day.
Totally. And I do have that. And the worry about doing podcasts and stuff is that I will, if you ask me a question, I will say the first thing that comes into my head. I will believe it so much. And then when this comes out, I'll listen back and be like, I don't think that at all. What the fuck are you talking about?
Why do you think you're like that? If that's how you identify yourself as like, oh, that's a habit of mine.
I don't know.
Why do you think you do that?
I don't know. It's a performance thing, I think, in whatever, like, situation I'm in, trying to just kind of impress the person that's sitting in front of me, either by making them laugh or making them think, like, wow, this is a genius, a very clever idea. Or however I can, just throwing everything at that in a way that does not facilitate you thinking in any serious way about what you mean or you know, how it's going to come, all of that stuff. And I think that what I challenge in the show, I guess, on some level, is try and link that to, like, you know, it's very social media influenced attitude to building yourself and your personality, to focus on kind of outward projection rather than inward consistency and integrity. So, yeah, did that answer the question?
No, that was a very, very erudite answer. So, is that... I've got so many things. For now, this is the bit now. I'm going to try and remember all those bits to come back to. Do you feel pressure to not be sincere online? I don't mean in the show. I mean in the world that the show is about.
Yeah.
Do you feel as a young person, as someone who heartbreakingly is closer in age to my children than me, and that's going to happen more and more and never stop happening? But do you feel under, like, I recognise a kind of internet voice. One of the things I talk about occasionally on the show, because it's a preoccupation of mine that I see it and I sort of appreciate it, but I'm terrible at it, is when people have crazily viral Instagram posts or whatever posts, whereby they're sort of doing, oh, I'm such a dork, look at me as I'm in a green room for a massive show I'm about to do.
Sure.
And they manage to effectively boast. It's not just a humble brag, it's something more finesse than that. It's like, it's a boast. A lot of the times, it's a reasonable boast. You know, I've done a thing that I'm really proud of, but no one ever says I'm proud of this. They do it in this sort of arch internet way.
Yeah.
I remember Helen Bauer having a go at me because she's like, Stu, you're so earnest. And I'm like, I am. I have to own that. I'm incredibly fucking earnest. I'm 46. You know, I'm just an earnest, but I just, you know, my things are like, oh God, no one must ever know what I really think. So I have to try and please everyone. That's a pressure for me. Is it a pressure for you not to be... Is there pressure for you and perhaps for people your age not to be sincere because it's like icky?
Yes, cringe. Definitely. Cringe.
That's the word Helen used. She said, I'm incredibly cringe. Cringe.
Yeah, it's cringe. Well, I think if you've grown up online, it's the idea that you could get across something you really feel in any kind of meaningful way via Instagram is so like page one insane to anyone who's had Instagram since they were 10 that I think when people try and do it, to me it's just like, oh my God, like what are you talking about? To be like, I'd just like to thank all of the people, the immediate gut level reaction is that is so, the performance is so transparent.
Ah, okay.
Because this obviously isn't the medium to communicate these serious thoughts through, because it's Instagram and we're all on it and we all know how we post stuff. So I'm meant to like delude myself that you're posting this out of the kindness of your own heart. No, darling. Absolutely not.
I think...
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I think it's very well explained. I think that... very well explained. Mm. It's a young person's guide to how not to be cringe. I think that people my age use Instagram almost as if it's email. Like, you might email someone, here's a thing that I think, or you might email several people, hey everyone, would you like to come and see a thing?
Yeah.
And so we treat social media like that, as if it's a means of telling people that we know, hey, I'd love it if you did this. And that's like an inherently, like, it's not necessarily a promotional, or it might be promotional, but it's not like... I don't think it has, for me, the idea of pretense, embedded in it, in the way that I think it does for younger people.
It just must take up such a different place in your life.
Yeah.
Because it's such a huge part of my life, because I spend 5 hours a day on my phone. And that's after it's gone down. That's like a low. 5 hours a day. And so it's like a primary way of interaction.
Do you know it's 5 hours? Have you like had one of those things?
It's like 5 hours, like 4 to 5 hours a day.
Sure, okay.
And so it's like a really primary way of interacting. But that's more than I see my friends, obviously. It's more than I'm interacting with the actual people that I'm engaging.
And that's true for me as well, to an extent. Not that amount of time, but I interact with my friends. Like I've experienced that thing where like I'm on Facebook because I remember I used to put my photos on Facebook. You could put your photos online. So you look back at anyone my age, you look back at like their Facebook photos from 10 or 15 years ago, they're the most ludicrous. They're literally like scans of real blurred photos because you only had a certain number of I mean, it's mind-blowing. I see my friends online. That's the reason I mentioned Facebook, is because like I've recognised that there are people who I feel like I'm friends with because the algorithm on Facebook has decided to show me their stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't actually know them that well. I don't actually see them very often.
Yeah.
And but for me, that is a thing that came in throughout my life, whereas for you, it was the existing conditions.
Yeah.
When you first got a phone.
Yeah.
That's what this is for.
Yeah,
Instagram
yeah.
has always been sort of facile and, you know what I mean, facetious. Yeah. You wouldn't dream of putting anything real on there. Whereas I think people of my age and beyond are sort of trying to cope with the fact that, oh, this is a means by which I can speak to people. So we say, I suppose it's the equivalent. I'm in the middle position between you and my dad's wife posting some boomer meme about something or other, you know what I mean? Or whoever, like a person who's my parents' age.
Yeah.
Posting like a, hey, send this to, you know what I mean? Like effectively chain letter type spam in a public post.
Yeah.
So I occupy a sort of central thing whereby I feel destabilised by it. Do you find it destabilising or do you feel comfortable that it means nothing?
Oh, no, I find it so destabilising. It's the most destabilising thing in the world, I think. But you get to a point, I think there's like been a tipping point, maybe. I'm talking like I'm a sociologist, so I have no idea.
No, not at all. I'm asking, requiring you to do that.
I have no idea what I'm talking about.
We will disclaim. Hey guys, we'll disclaim the entire episode with Leo doesn't know what the fuck.
I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. But I feel like there's been a tipping point, certainly since I was at school. I remember being a teenager, and everyone was, the whole thing was like the amazing power of connectivity in social media. And the amazing way that it can connect people from all over the world. And even if you live in a different country, to your cousin, you can send them a message. And that was the whole thing. And it was like the amazing sort of messianic Silicon Valley stuff in like the late 2000s, early 2010s. And I don't think there is a single person, maybe on Earth, apart from the people who work for the companies now, who, if you ask them, is social media good or bad for you, would go... good. It's just like such a... There have been enough seasons of Black Mirror now that we all know phones very scary stuff. But I think there's been like a... What I'm saying is I think there's been like a kind of cultural shift in our relationship to the internet in general broadly, but I think social media specifically, where everyone is so self-aware about how damaging it can be to our way of interacting with each other and the world. And how the kind of the 2016 election, I think, was a big part of that. Like at the end of the kind of love affair with social media as a form of self-expression. And I think I'm just really interested in the fact that even though I feel like that's happened, I still use my phone 5 hours a day.
Yeah.
So for me, what it makes is this like loop of, in the same way I do with like, I don't know, fast food or whatever, that's such a banal comparison. But I'll still use social media as much. I'll still like go on Twitter, but I'll know it's bad, so I'll just like feel guilt while I'm doing it.
Yes. You don't change the actions, you still
don't change
do all
the actions.
Actions
at all. Not at all. It's like a death drive kind of. Mm. And sometimes I can feel my like politics shifting as I'm scrolling. Or like I can feel like Even you read one tweet that's like one insane opinion, and I'm like, that's insane. Then you read like 14 more of the kind of the same angle, and you're like, well, actually, when you think about it like that, and you're like, oh my God, in real time, from outside my body, I'm watching myself, my morals decay.
I'll often, like, first thing in the morning or last thing at night, I'll think to myself, like, last thing at night, I'm going to go to bed now, I'm going to read my book. My book is on my phone, it's on Kindle, so I'm going to read that.
A huge mistake.
It's a huge mistake, but my wife has insomnia, I have to read in the dark. I can't, I'm going to do it. But the huge mistake is, I'll think, I'll just check Twitter, and... I'll think to myself, I will definitely have the thought, if I do that, I'll get sad or upset.
Exactly.
A horrible thing. I will see some horrible thing, either a horrible opinion or some horrible evidence of something awful happening in the world that I will have no ability to do anything about, and it will make me sad. And then I'll do it anyway. So I don't even think this time I'll be fine. I just think it can't be that bad. And then 3 minutes later, I'm like, oh God, what was I doing?
Yeah, well, I think the thing that I... Because that's such a thing, and I guess people have been saying that kind of stuff for probably almost 10 years now. But that, I think what I think is interesting is that we've I feel like forgotten that that wasn't always the relationship that people had to Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, whatever. And that that's been quite a slow drip of tying social media to social media used to be like a self-love thing.
Yeah.
And that's still sort of remnants of that in places. But now it's so totally a self-hatred thing. And usually people's relationships now, at least if I talk to my friends, their relationships with social media are so much more tied to the ways in which they... Or so much more self-consciously tied in the way into the ways in which they hate themselves than in projecting any kind of positive self-image.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened overnight, and it also wasn't... That wasn't the social media dream of when I was, like, at school and we'd have assemblies being like, how to harness the power of social media to put, you know, express your unique personality or whatever. That was the whole vibe, as far as I remember it.
Yeah. Do you think is there any...
Do you remember at the beginning when I was like, if you ask me a question, I will talk?
No, this is exactly what I want. This is fine. This is fascinating stuff. Trust me to steer you.
Well, I'm truly going to listen back to this and be like, that's so, so dumb. That sounds so dumb.
Well, I don't think so. Why would you... What are you defending for yourself by thinking that? That's not dumb. Everything you said is intelligent and well-reasoned. Do you think you'll change your mind on it?
Well, I think the other thing about this is that this kind of topic is that there's so much, like, discourse about this stuff that it's so deeply impossible not to sound like the most boring idiot alive who's making the most obvious... When I earlier compared social media usage to fast food,
yeah,
that made me feel low.
You picked yourself up on that immediately.
That
so
is like,
the idea
oh
of
my god, the sort are of you the, fucking kidding me?
The kind of the constant self-scrutiny.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, if I'll take some of this video and to advertise the podcast, I might put a clip on Instagram and I might put a clip of you being sincere, saying
no!
something that you actually think
that
and you'd
would
have to look
suck.
At it. Oh, Leo, could you post this?
And yeah,
you
yeah,
being
yeah.
Sincere?
And I
absolutely
would
not.
Read and not reply. No,
sure. Yeah. God. So as it pertains to your comedy, then this is the world that you're navigating in this show.
Yeah.
This is part. That's one of the worlds that you're navigating, and you are contributing to a discourse. You're not. You are contributing something sincere to it. You're not doing it in a sincere way, but you found a really funny, playful, ironic way to say some things you actually think.
Yes. Well, when we were developing the show, like before Edinburgh, the way I was trying to think about it was, you know, it is a confessional show, but it's like confession through irony. Rather than through earnestness. So you're still trying to reveal as much as possible about yourself and about myself and how I see the world and, you know, how I feel. But I realized that it would be kind of impossible to get at the feeling through the kind of like direct anecdotal stand-up that just didn't match the experiences that I was having or the tensions that I was feeling. Because ultimately it's like that for me, most of the stuff that I do in stand-up and in comedy in general is about, on some level, like just like believing or experiencing two like directly contradictory and like unreconcilable things at the exact same time. And it felt like to try and simplify that into a clean and satisfying, cathartic narrative about my life and the beautiful journeys that I'd had on it just didn't feel like the right mode of getting that across.
Great answer. Very sincere. I don't want you to to disavow that one later. Yeah. That was a good point. Should you ever happen to listen back or have this, any of this, should you be reminded of any of this? That's one I totally agree with. I think that's a very well-made point. I'm going to, I don't want you to come out of here being, oh God, I feel really sincere. I've been talking to Goldsmith for an hour and now I'm just, I keep thinking everything I feel.
No, I should clarify also. I do have thoughts and feelings and stuff. They are earnest.
Like, I don't believe you. You're the boy who cried. Well,
no, honestly, well, that was the other thing we kept talking about when we were working on the show is this idea of like a sincerity trap, or like people talk about a lot of people being irony poisoned. Whereas once you get to a certain level, it's incredibly difficult to work back to a stable core once you're at a certain kind of layer of performance, and people, you could very easily go, there's no core, the idea of a core is made up and it's fantasy anyway. But I definitely do feel like, in the show at least, there are points where the idea is that I'm really trying to be serious. And that because of the context of what I'm doing and what I'm wearing and how I'm coming across and the way I speak and the stuff that I have to clarify and undercut, it's just like literally impossible to do. And the language as well. I guess the other thing that I really think about social media is that it's so tied to advertising and to like to advertising language. And I think that once like a phrase or a certain way of speaking has been used by an ad,
yeah,
it's kind of impossible to get that back, yeah, like that, to reclaim the language, to express something
a
personal.
A brand moves in. I know that's one of my favourite memes is whenever someone posts "silence brand,"
with
like a laser eye mantis or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. But it's terrifying. Like when a that I really freaks me out when like Wendy's replies to McDonald's being like, "Meet you outside, bitch," or something, anything like that. And obviously the most harrowing one is when like a brand, like branded a company will post something about kind of World Coming Out Day, and it will be like, "At JP Morgan, we love to have be gay," and you're like, well. Now I don't want to say that I'm gay. Because you've done that. Because what could it possibly mean?
Yeah.
That your bank supports gay? Like, that doesn't make sense. What do you mean by that? And you've debased the language. And it was the only language we had. And I think we can't... The part of the idea was like, I think I find it really hard to express myself without the kind of cringe.
Yeah.
Because... if you're trying to express actually something you feel and the words that come out your mouth are the words of an ad, that's like one of the most humiliating things in the world.
I know you worked with wonderful, the late Adam Brace.
Yeah.
And he directed the show.
Yes, he did. Yeah, the live show, yeah.
And Adam was, and lots of people have quite rightly sort of talked about Adam's wonderful virtues as a man and as a director and what have you. I'm wondering, I sort of feel like it would be... dignified and deferent to say, tell us something brilliant about Adam and working with him first, because I then want to ask you about working with a director who's my age. So that tension is interesting. I think before we get into that, I should give you a space to tell us how great Adam was.
Well, I mean, they can be one and the same question.
Yeah.
Because the amazing thing about Adam, and that you have him to blame, I guess, also for me being so kind of... insanely verbose on this podcast and just kind of rattling off my opinions without a care in the world, is because the first time I sat down with him, I was at the point of like just starting to wear makeup on stage. I was still kind of in the middle ground of like kind of doing anecdotally stuff, but also trying to move away from that to something a little bit more heightened. And he was, and the first meeting I had with him, which was to vibe it out and see if we could have the same perspective on stuff, was the first time ever where someone who I really like respected and trusted was like, oh yeah, you should absolutely do that. And these sort of bigger ideas could be the whole thing. And you don't have to do like five at the start about you know, how like gay people are like this and straight people are like that, if you don't want to do that. And I think that was like a huge moment for me where I was like, oh, right. And I was like, right, but what if people don't laugh? And I don't like me. His whole perspective the whole time was like, oh, fuck him. Do you think he's good? That's how I talked. And that kind of... And he did this for loads of people. He really did it for me, that kind of... just like a really confident and clear sense of when he thought something was worth doing. And backed by just an encyclopedic knowledge of comedy, but also theatre and performance art, means just the world if you are fucking nowhere, random, like bombing so much I can't even tell you, to people who just do not care. That even on its own, even without having then obviously worked really intensely together on the show, that on its own would have changed my entire career and life.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So this is Leo. What a fun. It's like, it's lovely to get old in comedy. It's lovely. It's joyous and a privilege, as RuPaul tells us. It's a privilege to get older. It's a privilege to get older in comedy. And it's so fun to engage with someone so smart and focused and sort of engaged, grappling. I think what I love about Leo is that, as well as all of his charm and energy and his very fine comedy mind, he's really grappling with something. And it's so fun to join him and to grapple with Leo. Well, that sentence ended badly, but... Do you know what I mean? Like, I really enjoy getting into a serious thing in some depth. And this is what we did and what we continue to do. Coming up in the second half, we'll talk about how to determine what the next cultural moment is that needs to be tackled. We'll talk about his persona, his presence on stage. Of course, we'll find out whether he's happy. Place your bets now. Let's not turn that into a game. Or should we? That'd be quite a fun ComCom Pod drinking game. You're allowed 10 minutes into... No, you're allowed the midpoint and you need to guess, make a premonition for yourself as to what the answer will be when I ask whether the person is happy. Does that cheapen it? If it does, it cheapens us all. And so we're all in the same boat. Remember, the full episode is available to be watched at patreon.com/ComComPod and indeed at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, which leads to patreon.com/ComComPod. I'm going to deduplicate everything, but I haven't done it yet. So that's where you can go. You know, if you can find the Patreon, you've earned the right to join it. If you've still not switched over, if you're subscribed through AllSound, PayPal or Moonclerk, all of them previous iterations of the Insiders Club, please now pay attention to the email instructions you've been sent. If you can't find any or don't feel you were sent any, then just get in touch with me, Stuart@comedianscomedian.com, and I will sort you right out. So, full episode, over 30 minutes of bonus features, including this particularly wonderful idea about the genesis of Leo's show as a reaction, as a parody of the previous debut that he'd tried to make. All of that available on the Patreon if you're a Patreon person, an Insiders Club member/insider. Right, I hope by the time you've listened to this, I'll have got over the debacle that it's too late to warn you of in advance, whereby I took my award-winning... Best show at the Leicester Comedy Festival 2023 show, spoilers, back triumphantly to the Leicester Comedy Festival and found out yesterday that I had been misinformed that it was near sellout, didn't bother to promote it, and then found out yesterday that that was misinformation, an accident, and an understandable and completely forgivable accident. But nonetheless, I'm now taking my triumphant victory show back to a quiet room which I will enjoy nonetheless, because comedy will keep you humble and let's inhabit that and breathe into it. And I love doing that show and it's fun. So let's assume that the next time we speak, I will tell you all about how well it went, despite, or I'll either tell you that it massively blew up and sold out and I didn't even have worried, or I'll tell you about the very special, lovely, sober time that I had with a handful of audience members. I'm also, and this is something I'm not going to fail to promote, I'm also at the Wells Comedy Festival in May, and also I'm going to be at the McCuntland Comedy Festival, both with spoilers. It's a really good show. Come and see it. It made a bunch of people at a sustainability conference grip my hand, look deep into my eye and say thank you. Like several of them did that afterwards. But it's also good for normal people. All right. So come and see that there. All of the links that you need are at stuartgoldsmith.com. And Callum, please put them in the show notes as well. Let's assume he did that. They're in the show notes. So let's get back without further ado to Mr. Leo Wright.
Given that you went, you were like Cambridge Footlights and you were doing sketch shows in Edinburgh and you were kind of ready and you're clearly smart and funny and you write. No, come on.
Single.
Yeah, right. Okay. I think the listenership for this show isn't going to help with that.
Yeah, probably not. But give it a go. If you're on the fence and you're listening, give it a go.
Interview has one core value. It's that you should definitely have a crack.
Have a crack at it. Why not?
Why not? I think that it's easy to kind of see those things and the, like, it's production values, whatever that means, like in every aspect of it. And you could see that and go, oh, has Leo been grown in a lab? Is there foreign investment in Leo? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and you joke about, you know, my dad's company sponsored the show, Deutsche Bank, whatever. But it's you could sort of go, this has been designed either by or with people who know what the fuck they're doing. It's like there could be a world in which 23, I guess, when you were making it, 22-year-old Leo showed promise, and I mean this, I feel like this used to happen in the days of DVD advance deals. You know, people would go, this kid's gonna be big, let's give him 30 grand, and then he can pay all these different people. Like, there's a
That's what it's meant to, that was the idea as well. That's the idea, is it's meant to be like, it's meant to feel. I mean, I talk so much about how young I am. And the idea of the show is it's like a, on some level, as well as being a slight send up of those like confessional stand up shows, it's also hopefully on some level a send up of like a kind of young industry plant show.
That's the term I wanted. An
like
industry
a focus
plant.
Group, yes. Pop star that emerges, whose parents are weirdly like head of EMI or whatever. Yeah, that was the energy that I wanted to have in it. Yeah, so all of those, like, all of the things, like, everything has to look, like, right.
Sure.
And the sound and the music, and we've got a really great friend to produce the tracks to make them
a Tony Award-winning great friend.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Toby I wrote the songs with, and then Nikki Green, who's amazing, produced the tracks, like made the tracks, and we would like talk about like reference points and trying to make it sound like kind of a, I don't know, like a, one of the songs is like a B-side Billie Eilish track, or like a this one needs to sound like Rosalia or whatever, and all of that to try and be like this is someone, like you said, sort of like designed to try and like capture the zeitgeist in that kind of really clinical, like, like that really, like, overthought, like, corporate way that people try and capture the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Like, talking about every issue that's, like, a buzzword without saying anything ever, and hitting all the, like, right hooks in the songs, but they're 4 seconds long, or whatever, like that kind of stuff. That was so at the heart of it, the feeling that like cultural production being so shallow, and trying to send that up as well as and make that undercut the idea that I was actually expressing anything, like even in just aesthetically.
Did you have to walk a sort of a daily tightrope between sending that up and actually being that?
Yes. I don't know if I'm on the tightrope anymore. But that was, yeah, it's weird.
Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're so all of weird. Those things you sort of talked about, like, you do talk about all those buzzwords. You're sending it out, but you do talk about them.
I know,
You're sending up the massive production values and the you know, the industry plant thing. But you're also, like, you're a Cambridge Footlights guy who's smashed it with a really good show that had the best director and the best team behind you and everything.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
It's like the central central contradiction of it is that it's I guess on a much more basic level, it's like I'm being like, it's so bad when people do this, but I'm doing it and it's good when I do it, you know, like that. And I think hopefully the idea was, and I don't know if this is such like a weaseling out of this question, but the idea was that that's kind of the point of the show in general, like a much like bigger way is like, and sort of hating something and being it at the same time. And kind of that is the, it's not really a solvable problem because you are the thing that you hate. And that kind of loop being, it's impossible to get out of. And I think that's the same kind of like the sort of sincerity irony thing that we were talking about earlier. It's like, as much as I could send up privilege or whatever, it's like, yeah, not really though. I can't really. Like it's not really possible to remove myself and look at things in a kind of, objective or critical way. For any of that stuff, I don't think.
Do your parents have their own Wikipedia pages?
No.
I think that's it. Is that a relief?
Yeah.
It is. If the show wasn't as funny as it is, it's so funny and so charming. It's so good. I sort of felt comfortable asking what could be quite a provocative question because obviously I love your work and I think you're great.
It's like that. It's also what the show's about on some level. So it's like, I can't not answer the question.
Does that mean that the follow-up show, the next show, has to be, I've got this feeling of like, I'm just seeing you in jeans and a plaid shirt with a guitar doing a real sincere thing.
I really want to do that. That's actually, I think it will be something like that. It'll definitely be. I definitely don't want to do the same.
But now your audience like that. Don't they want to cut?
I don't care about my audience. This is for me.
Yes.
This is all for me.
Beautiful. But presumably.
My audience. There's like four of them. It's fine.
Come on, you've got an HBO special, you cunt. Come on. Four of them.
That's what, yeah.
Surely five by Christmas. So that, I mean, that is interesting in terms of what you do next and where you're going next. And you were writing today. You were so at the moment you're deep in writing. What are you writing? Is it like, is it more stand up? Or are you like,
no.
I'll turn up with my debut, get an HBO special, and then retire undefeated and then learn how to do something else?
No, I would like to keep doing stand up forever, but I.
It's so hard to find the time with writing a movie.
So hard to find the time. You know what it's like. No, I think just after doing, because that the this show, I mean, I'm talking about it like I'm doing it now. I started doing it over almost 2 years ago. Probably about 2 years ago, I started the first work in progress of it was probably 2 years ago, and that's a really long time. And it has jokes in it. There are a couple of jokes in that show that I probably wrote when I was 18. And so it just feels like, I think for stand-up at the moment, it feels like, let's let that kind of rest for a second while I kind of figure out what the fuck what's going on and like that kind of stuff. But also like just sort of creatively, I don't think that I have much more to say about the stuff that I was talking about in this special. And I think that the character and the persona and the way that I did the show and what I'm wearing, all this stuff that we were talking about was so specifically designed for the show to be about that stuff. And it's all hopefully interconnected. So it feels like one thing. And I'd like ideally to be able to do that again, but for a different idea, but to do that, means you have an idea.
Yeah.
Which is so hard.
And is it, like, seeing as the vast majority of your stand-up experience is doing that persona.
Mm-hmm.
And that persona is not miles away from how you're talking to me now. It's you, right? It's the way you operate. So you found a beautiful way to encapsulate that funny self and for that funny self to breathe and speak and sing in this wonderful kind of self-referential snow globe of like the concept itself. Brilliant. You're still you. So you're carrying you to the next project.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Well, I mean, I'm saying this being like, it's going to be complete. I'm not going to be like a fucking trucker. Like, it's not going to be that. It's going to be me speaking.
Yes.
And I just don't know what it's going to be, basically. Yeah. And I don't think that it should be the same. I don't know. I think that conversation is just culturally... is sort of wrapping up as well. And I think it was sort of and I hope that it hasn't wrapped up because I want people to watch the show. But
it would be nice if they're watching the show. It'd be nice if them watching the show was the last moment that conversation
conversation. What I'm really saying, I think, is that I ended the conversation about social media. No, I
what is the next? As one of the most zeitgeist guests I've spoken to in recent times, what's next? What's next, young person?
I do.
What's everyone shitting themselves about now? What are you getting tendrils of that you're like, oh, maybe that's going to be huge and awful that I would never even know about?
Oh, my God. I wish I knew. I wish I knew. I mean, nothing's great, though, is it?
Mm-hmm.
It's really not. It's not great. Great vibes in general. I would hate to speculate about what do I think is going to go worst in the next 10 years.
Yeah, I suppose that's it, isn't it?
Is that your question?
It's the next challenge.
What's
isn't
the
it?
Worst yeah, what's thing the that's worst... going to happen?
Yeah. Climate, war, food crisis.
But those are my all. Top three. I think this is so bleak, but I think probably we've had the kind of like pre-fascism preamble. Mm. And probably like fascism proper version, I imagine will happen. So people who saw fascism preamble and were like, I could do that, but really well. And then they do that. I think that's probably coming. I don't want to be a downer on the Comedian's Kingdom podcast. I really have talked like I'm a professor today. I don't know anything. I'm just going to reiterate that as well. But I think the thing that I worry about online at the moment is that just... really strong and reactionary political beliefs in it gaining a lot of ground among people who would have otherwise probably turned out as progressives is like, uh-oh. So maybe that's funny.
And do you think leaving to one side a lot of the weight of that, which is, I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. And maybe that is funny.
Yeah.
Leaving it like, kind of, sort of looking at that through a lens, like taking a sort of step removed.
It's the only way to do it. What am I going to do? I'm not going to solve it.
Well, this is it. What does your work
do? Nothing. That's a truly, I really don't think anything. Well, that's part of the thing as well. It's like, we gotta, in my opinion, get over the idea that we're making concrete political change by getting on stage in front of, I mean, even thousands of people, but hundreds of people and telling jokes or stories or whatever. I hope that the show or like the stand-up has an effect on people and I hope they take stuff away from it. But this kind of, and I see this still so much, although I think that this again is like sort of trailing off a little bit. But the thing of like there's, you know, the most political action is telling your story, which is true about, well, not, I mean, which I think is a really valuable idea, certainly for lots of communities that really haven't had platforms to do that. But the way that that's bled into people like me with my background feeling empowered to go, and the most political thing I could do is get up on stage and tell my story about how one time at school someone was like, you're gay. It's like, that is not, there's, we, that we have to delineate the you know, it's political for sure, but I don't know if it's politics in, like a, in the concrete sense of the word. Not that I, oh my God, what am I talking about though? Because that's great and everyone should do what they want.
Yes, it's a the most political act you can do is tell a story provided we haven't heard it before.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it's not a non-political thing to do, but what am I saying? What was the original thing that I was trying to say with that? I have no idea.
We were talking about what
you the effect.
Does. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I am skeptical of the extent to which there's a great, like, there's a great, at the risk of really just sounding like the biggest cunt that's ever been on this podcast, probably this is going to get only hatred in the comments, but there's a great, I think it's a Kurt Vonnegut quote where about satire having like all the effect of pushing a cream pie off a stepladder or something. It's better than that. He does it better.
He was very good. He's very good.
No, honestly, he's such a smart guy. And, but even more important than that, kind. And a laugh. No, I just think that a little bit more self-awareness about the about the kind of extent to which the ripples happen out from your, from my, I'm saying this again, this is self-reflection, not outward criticism. I certainly thought that when I was doing my confessional hour about coming out or whatever, which is what I talked about for most of that, I definitely was thinking at the time, like, this is going to be fucking game change for a lot of people. No.
No, well, maybe not, no. But then equally, I think when
it's nice to have,
when people do comedy that is, you know, racist or homophobic or those that, I wince because I think that is, do you know what I mean? We wince, we go, fuck. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, your wince sounded like, yeah.
I wince. I mean, it's fine, but I wince.
I think when people do stuff that is really offensive, part of what offends us is the idea that, like, fuck, I don't want people to agree with that.
Yeah.
So if that's the, like, I don't just not want people to agree with it. I feel like it has a negative effect. That's my point. When
yes.
someone does homophobic actually, or racist bullshit or misogynist stuff, you feel that has a negative effect. And so, but surely the flip side of that coin is when someone does something that is reflective and honest and interesting and gives a different perspective
totally.
And is funny, surely it has a positive effect.
Totally. And I think that stuff, yes, I do think it has a positive effect. And you create a cultural landscape which feels welcoming for people to share experiences and turn their experiences into art is amazing. I think, what was I going to say? Oh, I think that, well, I think it's because we were talking about, you know, because you asked me what the worst thing was going to happen in the next 10 years. I think I was thinking very specifically in like a very concrete, like political way. No, of course. I mean, I think that, certainly for me, when I was a teenager, when I watched, to be my one was Simon Amstel. I'd watch Simon Amstel. I'd be like, being gay is actually pretty funny, you know. And it was massively emotionally useful and a real like breakthrough for me in terms of, you know, emotionally as a person. I think that I think all I was speaking to you there was like the feeling of like considering the place we are in politically. I think that the feeling I get amongst a lot of people is that is politics as a form of self-expression. Rather than anything more kind of, I don't know, like community oriented or you know, practical, not that you can't have both, but, I worry. I think that the thing I was saying about like the sort of reactionary TikToks that I see from teenagers, which I know are just designed to fuel paranoia and fear. But I worry in general about the way in which, you know, you can have politics as an asset, as a element of your personality now, without necessarily being forced to consider the material implications of that. And yeah, I think that's going to be the hard thing in the next few years, is sort of does that make sense?
I think so.
I was sort of I'm begging on my knees for you to cut it out.
I was hoping you were going to recap the point you made, because it sounds very intelligent, but I don't know that I totally followed it.
And that is my biggest skill. If I have one skill, it's
something about
almost good, but what the fuck are you talking about?
Come on, don't lose. Just say that in a sentence. Because I know you think it, and I think it's legitimate and real.
Well, I'll do it in terms of the show. It's like in my own show. No, the thing of the thing of having a provocative stated opinion. Yeah, it costs nothing to state your opinion online or in general as a form of self-expression of like, this is who I am as a person. And I think it's becoming increasingly, you know, like it having more and more cachet to have a opinion to make your political identity in some way reactive to the world as it is now, a kind of burn it down, especially on the right, and especially in progressive circles, people moving to the right and being like, identity politics, fucking shit, and no, there's no real change, and you know, really kind of violent stuff, which is fine, but the way in which that clashes when the words become actions, I think is slightly scary.
Yes, good. That made sense. Good.
What am I doing? I have a comedy show. It's a comedy show. It's laugh a minute. Don't make me say any more about that. Favorite Christmas cracker joke or something? Or
With writing this show, what kind of a writer, what kind of a joke writer are you? Are you a look out the window, something falls into your head person?
No.
Are you a claw at the coal face and with bleeding knuckles until you get something? What does it look like?
So top down, and I've never once had a thought come into my head randomly, I don't think. I'm never like, oh, looking around like, oh, yeah, isn't it funny how... No, never. I'm not like a natural... I'm not like a natural comic, as I'm sure you've discovered over talking to me over the past hour. I'm more of a kind of like, oh, no. That's more of my feeling in general. I just loved comedy so much that I forced my... unnaturally make myself do it because I think it's fun. But I really go like, I would like to write a joke about this. And then I walk around my room talking out loud about that thing.
Right. Right. Great. You start off with, that's what you mean by top down. You start off with, I want to talk about this and I want to find a way to make that funny so that I can talk about it.
Yeah.
So then you'll pace around your room saying things out loud to yourself like a mad person.
Yeah.
Until something comes out and
it's
go.
It's usually like, if I want to talk about it, it's usually because I think there's something funny about it. Or something like makes me feel ill about it. It's usually something that makes me feel like, oh no.
Can you give us an example of the kind of the genesis and kind of a specific joke from your show where you remember that process?
Oh god. Yes, I probably can. What do I talk about?
Or that old people bit, because I love that bit. And it must suck to be old.
Yeah, I think that, well, that was me. I think that was just that was a sense of anger to that I was feeling towards old people. And I was like, that's really funny because that's insane. You can't do that. That's, like, I'm pretty sure that's... I don't think it's a protected characteristic, but it's certainly not great to sort of hate a generation. And it was in lockdown, and I was feeling, like, so self-pitying about my youth fading away at the same time, you know, all that shit. And I think it was just out of... like, I was like, this feels funny to me because it's so... it's such an irrational hatred and such... And it was built off also... the same things that people always make fun of about old people being like, the past was so amazing. And I was like, I believe that now because I feel like my present's so bad and I should complain about it all the time that I'm now thinking, if only I was born in the 60s and, you know, grew up when houses were so cheap, you know, that kind of stuff, which is a fantasy in itself. And I thought it was funny that I'd walk around my room being like, what do I actually think about this? Where is this coming from? Do I actually think that if I was born in the past, my life would be easier? No, obviously, if I think about it for 1 second. But the romantic idea that I might have, like, grown up without a phone and everything was simple and you'd your life was like a rom-com and whatever. Contrasting with my real sense of despair and doom, which also is insane about my own life, one of the easiest lives in human history. That felt really funny to me, that I was like in bed every day being like, this is so fucking hard. Meanwhile, my mum is bringing me a coffee. Do you know what I mean? What is going on? I think that was the... And then that gradually forms into, like, what are the... you write down the list of all the things. You're like, that... is it, like, the climate change that they caused that? And then, you know, that... So it's that...
That bit that you've gone... Tell me about that bit. You have the concept. You're walking around your room.
And I'm like... isn't it unfair that we have to deal with the consequences of other people's actions? There was a joke earlier about, you know, I don't like dealing with the consequence of my own actions. There was a joke about, there was a version of it that was like, it was like, my parents make a mistake and I have to pick up the pieces. It is a very cruel reversal of the dynamic I'm used to, or like that kind of thing. And it just gradually, like, kind of... yeah, just sort of whittles down into, like, the real... What's the point you're trying to make and what's the most stupid way you could possibly say it? Because obviously I don't think that... just clarify. Do you not think that that an entire generation of people have culpability over climate change? But I think that it was an expression of a real sense of generational divide and intergenerational animosity that I was feeling. Climate change seems to be the funniest way of doing it.
And are you taking this stuff on stage? Like, at what point do you take it on stage when you're putting this stuff down?
Do I like working out on stage? God, I wish so much. I see people do that. I'm like, that's so cool. Get up there, just like, yeah, I'm just gonna riff for like 5 minutes and just like see if this is anything. Can you imagine? So nice. So nice. No, I get up there sweating buckets, absolutely tense as anything, with my little perfectly crafted little one-liners that no one laughs at, and I go, okay, that's fine, not that one.
Do you have to learn like a whole new
five
minutes?
Yeah, learn it like it's a play.
Wow. God, I would be physically unable to
really.
To remember it. No, I wouldn't be able to remember it. And I always regard memorizing things as so difficult and painful to do.
Yeah.
That I can't do it, and I know it won't work. And I think, well, what's the point in putting all this effort and pain into remembering a thing before you know whether it's funny?
Yes.
Completely the other way around.
Whereas
here's you with an HBO special.
Oh my God. No, I couldn't be... I think the fluidity thing as well also just comes from, like, you know, on some level, if you're going to go up and riff, you do have to believe that you're quite charming.
And you're extraordinarily charming.
Okay, we're absolutely waiting for you to jump in and kind of comment on that. I'm not a warm presence on stage. I don't make people feel comfortable. I never have done that. And it was a real journey to be like, that's fine, actually. And stop trying to kind of, because there's a, if you're, I have like a extreme desperation about me. In life, but also, I'm mainly talking about on stage, but in life. And it took a really long time. And that was part, that was a big part of like developing how I like to do stand-up, is being like, Can I erase this sense of desperation? And the answer was no. But I couldn't do it. I tried to be charming. I'd be like, and what do you do as a job? You know, it's like really, oh God, you're right. And just leaning into it and leaning into the kind of slightly like manic, like something's going on behind this guy's eyes. Everything's a little bit too precise. It's a little bit too polished to feel like comfortable. Ended up being the best way of masking the fact that I'm too desperate for the approval of the audience to the extent where it ruins any sense of casualness. So I can never like MC. I'm so bad at it.
That's nuts, because it's not nuts. That's exactly, that's the whole thing. It's nuts that it takes so long for everyone to get there, myself included, to recognise that the job is to be yourself.
Mm.
And everything around you suggests that the job is to be something else and to be what you think you're supposed to be and what you imagine you're supposed to be and what, like, the people you think are brilliant. And the actual, it's like this enormous kind of impossible self-actualizational shift,
yeah,
to go, oh, those things that I'm trying to hide are the things.
Yeah, totally. And also, the thing with being a comedian and with any job like it, I think, is because there's obviously no kind of rules to follow, and there's no way of doing it that guarantees anything, guarantees a good response from the audience, guarantees success in any bigger way. I think people are always looking to make rules about what you should and shouldn't do and how it's best to do stuff, and so that there's just like some kind of structure to cling to. And the rules are always wrong. And I think that's that was definitely an experience of like starting out doing stand-up, especially in London, where you'd go to gigs and people would be like, well, the thing you have to do is you have to gig 900 times a week, otherwise you should be shot in the head. Or on the other hand, being like, you should only do gigs where you know that's going to be your kind of audience, because all of the other gigs will make you not trust your material. Or like any of this stuff where it's like the route map stuff is like, you've got to get an agent now, because then by the time or you've got to like wait to do Edinburgh and you've got to have 45 minutes and then you do an hour and then you do an hour and 45 minutes. All of that stuff being like, oh my God, it's not important enough to think about it like that. And thinking about it like that is so insane and makes and bleeds into everything you then do, I think. And having to kind of really try and unthink a lot of that stuff and relax and fucking relax for a fucking and have a nice time, I think was such a part of getting actually comfortable doing something that I felt like I was good at.
Leah.
Yes.
Are you happy?
I'm so happy. I really want the recording to carry on for as long as possible so that we don't have to reflect. That's sort of my vibe in general. Just,
yeah. You're happy. You're happy despite the fascism, despite the outside world, despite the internet, despite all the awfulness.
Yeah.
You're not like a comic who is kind of racked by self-doubt. Or if you are, still happy.
I guess I'm happy.
I'm not trying to convince you you're not
no,
happy.
No, I mean, it's... definitely riddled by self-doubt. I think that's part of it. That's fine. And happy, yeah, in general, I think. But it's hard to say for certain. I feel like my experience of being happy is usually you look back on... Like you suddenly feel sad, then you're like, oh, I was happy. You know, it was when you like have a blocked nose, And you're like, oh my god, remember when I did have a blocked nose and I could taste food? That was fucking great. You never know. You never know walking around being like, oh my god, I don't have a blocked nose today. I'm like, woohoo! My life's perfect. Was that a good answer? Was that a sad answer? Maybe I'm not happy.
So that was Leo. Thank you so much to Leo for coming onto the show. I've really enjoyed that. That's a real kind of came out of that interview absolutely buzzing and just with my head really electrified and excited. Remember, Literally Who Cares? Leo Reich, Literally Who Cares? Is streaming on HBO Max in the US and on Sky in the UK. And it's his fucking debut. Admittedly, a finely tooled, planned, cleverly developed, deftly worked out debut, but a debut nonetheless. On HBO Max, imagine that, and Sky. You can follow Leo on Twitter at Leo is Tired, and you can follow Leo _ Reich on Instagram. That's the difference, isn't it? It's whether you pronounce it Reich or Reich. And I didn't check with him, and I don't know. You can see my award-winning climate show, spoilers, at the Leicester Comedy Festival a few days ago, depending on when you're hearing this. And also, you can see me at the Wells Comedy Festival and the Machynlleth Comedy Festival with Spoilers, the show that The Times called the funny side of climate change. No, really. I wish I could solve this. How do you fucking get people to come and see a show that they know is about climate change, even if you know that it's fucking hilarious? It's so hard, and I think it might be the work of the rest of my life. Oh, that's aggravating. How annoying to have a mission. A reminder that the Insiders Club has now moved to Patreon, so you can get full video episodes, extra content in video as well as audio, exclusive guest announcement, and new membership offerings like the monthly Q&A, which is a Q&A with me with a fun title, and which I'm about to record soon. Submit your questions if you're in the Insiders Club. Use the Patreon app to submit your questions now. You'll also get access to the full back catalogue of extras. Someone got in touch and said, hey, the older extras aren't on the Patreon. And they certainly are. We've checked. So go to patreon.com/comcompod for more info. Thank you to our insider producers who are Sam Allen, Jay Lucas, Gary McClellan, Dave. Oh, that's interesting. Miles Walsh, Andres Perday, Caroline Schmidt, Jonathan Stewart, Richard Lucas, Paul Swaddle, James Burry, Ashley Stewart, and Mike Sheldon. And a big thank you to our special and very fancy insider executive producer. There's only one of him. It's Neil, the real deal, Peters. Thanks, Neil. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening. Do you know what? I've not only got a spare 5 minutes now before I get interviewed for a thing. I've got a spare 5 minutes to post-amble at you, and I'm pretty bloody sure that I made a list of a thing to talk about. I did tour support last night and the night before for Joe Wilkinson. And Joe Wilkinson is so much more famous than I realised. Of course, he's famous from Chatterbix. But he didn't even tell the Chatterbix audience, apparently. He didn't even mention it. My wife is a Chatterbiscuit and had no idea that he was working up some new material. And he's selling out these big rooms in moments on the basis of no promo because he's incredibly famous. And I just hadn't realised. I mean, I know, obviously, he's just one of those people that I've known him forever. Me and Joe Wilkinson and Lee Bannard, I was going to say sadly no longer with us. Sadly no longer with us in the comedy industry, but very much with us in the world. And just, he was the first person I knew who, not bravely, but what's the word? It's someone who was a really good comic with the world at their feet who went, nah, not for me, and went off and did something else and had a proper life. God love him. And you, if you're him, because I know you listen. And also Diane Morgan. The four of us did an Edinburgh four-hander, a split four-hander show. It was called Four on the Floor. It didn't need to be. That was my suggestion. I thought it needed a cool name, and I Googled all of the idioms with four in them. Four on the Floor. It makes sense, but it would be a cool name if Four on the Floor was something that we said in the UK as opposed to a handful of car enthusiasts in the States. But I got away with it. I think everyone just found my irrepressible Duracell buddy-like energy utterly exhausting and just let me do whatever I wanted with the production of that show. Apologies. I've talked about this before, but every day I'd turn up and Lee, Diane and Joe would be like, God, I don't want to do this anymore. That's a plumber. I haven't got time to re-record it. You'll have to put up with the plumber. They'd turn up and I'd be injecting loads of sort of passion and energy into the show and all of them would be like, oh God, this again. And where are they now? Happy. All three of them. So Joe, who is a listener to the podcast and a friend and a lovely, lovely man, and I, we did these shows and I'm just so desperate. Basically, I don't think he'll come on the show. I don't think he'll come on the podcast, but I know he listens. And so he and I basically did a mini ConCon with him, unrecorded, Sorry, it's a plumber. There's nothing I can do about it. And do you know what he's doing? He's putting a radiator into the cellar just in time for spring. That's on me. So Joe and I basically did the lost episode of Comedian's Comedian, whereby I asked him all the stuff I would have asked him. Fascinating answers. And it wouldn't be fair for me to share any of that information with you. But let's all just imagine what he might think about stuff. Yeah. Yeah, he sees it like that. Yes. Yes, and he's always... Yeah, exactly. But he's never... Yes. And so the key difference between he and I in our approach early doors was... Right? I mean, staring me in the face now. And I never realised at the time that's what I was doing. But he didn't do that. He cleverly did that instead. And as a result, look where it's got him. He's so funny. Jesus, the new... Was that annoying? That was really annoying, wasn't it? Sorry. I'd love to tell you. I won't. Thanks, Mike. I mean, I could just pause, couldn't I? And then Callum could... He could take these bits out. We don't have time. I'm about to be interviewed about coaching. Coaching. 2 points. One is that Joe is really... God, he's funny. God, he's funny. I wish I could... Obviously, it's new material and you wouldn't want to quote someone's jokes anyway, but I could tell you 5 jokes off the top of my head right now, which are just such bangers. And he is so methodical and precise and brilliant. And he just gets his whole persona. He said this before, I'm sure, out loud. So I don't think this is betraying trust. But he does his material from the perspective of the weirdo on the bus. And that it's so funny because it just gives him license to talk about whatever he wants. And so the show is incredibly rich and dense with jokes. And when it's finished and he officially announces it, get in quick. Because I suspect he's not the sort to wallow around in an extended tour. I think when it turns up, get on your local theatre's mailing list now in case he's coming there, because you don't want to miss it. It's just brilliant. The other element of it is that he gave me real free rein to really, to be, I was going to say fuck about, but let's say stay loose. I was really loose in support. It worked fantastically in Taunton. It worked well in Bath, and there were certainly highlights. I don't think I've achieved the consistency of the highlights of the looseness. But I'm so grateful because those gigs both now are in the same pot of gigs in my mind as Burnham-on-Sea, which I think I may have told you about in the last post, Amble, where I was loose as fuck, did half an hour at headlining a gig with only 60 people in a big hall, not much of a vibe. Everyone had done very well and done their best on the bill, but not much of a vibe. And I really seized it by the throat and managed to seize it by the throat, but not tighten up myself. Like, I grabbed the gig. The metaphor's confusing. I grabbed the gig. I seized the gig, but remained loose and improvisational. I did maybe half an hour with probably only 2 prepared bits, 2 jokes at the end. The rest of it was very, very loose, riffy stuff. And it reminded me, I was describing it to Joe. The reason it's so exciting was that in 2019, when I did Primer, I did that thing where I had the words on a screen of like, and I changed the words. I'd change about a third of the words every day, like bullet points of things I'd just thought of. So I was doing new material, but loose concepts I'd thought of that day. And it was awesome. And I came out of it. We talked about this at the time, you and I. I came out of it thinking, why does anything need to be finished? I think what I love doing is sort of playing with these amorphous, unfinished, you know, it was like a new material tour. God, it was good. And I managed to get that same sense of realness and presence and in the momentness. And I came off, and I will think of this very fondly when I'm older and greyer. But Joe said to me, oh, that's good. You've created a thing there where you can't not be funny. And he was like, I felt very confident in like, whoa, growth. This is good. And then to have someone as funny and friendly and lovely as Joe kind of, and someone as brilliant as Joe, kind of confirm that. It felt like an extra little pat on the head, which would have been patronising were he not so tall and such. As such, it felt appropriate. So that's good. So I'm in a really good mood. I've got to tell you all about Green Biz. I was at a... Have I got time? No. Future episode, I'll tell you all about Green Biz. I went to a huge sustainability conference with massive, massive corporate people there who really have their mitts on the levers of power and are really genuinely driving change. And it went great. Oh, God, it went great. And I've, so new mailing list, you've got an option now. If you are listening to this, if you happen to be a climate person, when you go to stuartgoldsmith.com, you can opt in to climate or resilience or stand up and podcast. So if you want to be kept abreast of climate stuff, I will sort of funnel that into there. So if you happen to work in any sort of sphere of of the business world and you want to know about the resilience stuff, or if you happen to work in sustainability to any level, you can opt into those on the mailing list. And I will tell you all about it. And I've got some great video from the conference, like a huge, like literally 1,000 corporate sustainability people in a room. And I was able to address them and talk passionately about a thing I care about, and using comedy to sort of get into the cracks, the ambiguities in sustainability comms and messaging, and try and actually offer something useful and a fresh perspective. And it was absolutely fucking exhilarating, mate. It was great. It was so great. So more on that at some point, if I can sort of turn it into a if I can speak it in a language in which it feels appropriate to do so on the pod. But for now, that will do us. Don't miss Leo Reich's show on HBO Max if you're in the States, or Sky if you're in the UK. Remember, Leo is Tired on Twitter and Leo_Reich on Instagram. You can find me at stuartgoldsmith.comedy on most things apart from Twitter, where I'm at ComComPod. And this is a podcast brought to you from comedianscomedian.com, which is soon going to look very, very different. So for now, just go to stuartgoldsmith.com and find out anything you need. The show was logged by Susie Lewis. It was produced by producer Callum Morin. I've been Stuart Goldsmith, and the music was by Rob Smouten, as ever. So everything? Is it? Yes. Do you know what? Do you know we try... I picked up Mr. Matt Crosby's suggestion of saying, let's all try and... retain a consistent sense of self at the end of episodes, and I used it as a give us a cheer last night in Bath. That was a lot of fun to effectively open with. Give me a cheer if you have a consistent sense of self. What a lovely thing that was. Lovely little thread to pull at that I look forward to continuing. So do that if you're able. Bye bye.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.